You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, June 29th, 2017, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, Steve.
Evan Burns.
Well, that was predictable.
And we have a special guest this week, George Shrub. George, welcome to the show,
hey,
man.
George.
Hi.
So we're here at Nexus 2017. We had a little bit of a hiccup even before the conference started. There was a fire, and apparently there was some carbon monoxide, right? Was that the
problem? Yeah, so what I heard was there was a fire in the basement, and the fumes got up into the air conditioning vents, and they couldn't get the contractor out to do a thorough cleaning to meet the fire regulations to get rid of the carcinogens.
So the fire department said, nope, you can't use these rooms. Yep. So 3 days before the conference, we find out our rooms are shut down. Yeah, but we took care of it. Mike Feldman, he was the man on the spot, and he found new rooms for everybody, for everything.
He called me up and he's like, Jay, yeah. He goes, oh boy. I'm like, what? It's Tuesday, Mike. What? What's wrong? And it couldn't have been worse. He goes, we don't have a venue. That's all. We don't have a venue.
Right. So then Jay calls me and he goes, Steve, oh boy.
Yeah.
I know something you don't know.
Something you don't want to know.
And then but Jay called me.
No. It all worked out. So we're just going to dive into some news items. Evan, I actually want to start with yours.
Oh, okay.
You have an update on the whole glyphosate, Monsanto is evil, but maybe not story. What's going on?
Monsanto is evil, right. That's a meme now, isn't it, or something? Yeah. Glyphosate. It is an herbicide, the active ingredient in Monsanto Company's popular Roundup weed killer. We all know about that. It has been added to California's list of chemicals known to cause cancer, and it goes into effect July 7th, just in a few days. This is despite the recent findings by organizations such as the European Chemical Agency, which showed that there is no link between glyphosate and cancer. And in addition, according to a report recently published from a joint United Nations and WHO meeting on herbicide residues, that report states that glyphosate does not cause cancer.
Right.
So what's up, California? I think what's happening here is that California might be relying perhaps too much on another arm of the World Health Organization called the Agency for Research on Cancer, International Agency for Research
IARC,
on Cancer.
Yeah.
Right. And they said, this was back in 2015, and I know we covered it at the time, that it is probably carcinogenic.
They said the same thing about bacon, right?
Yeah, and caffeine.
Yeah.
And
they have a very low threshold.
They have a very low threshold. They tend to play it extremely cautious, extremely conservative.
As does California.
Yeah.
Like pretty much every building you walk into where I live, there's a sign that says...
This building is causing
cancer. Yeah, something in... Like there are substances known by the state of California. It always says by the state of California to be carcinogenic. Pretty much anywhere you go, it says that in California, like daycares,
Across the border into California. Cancer. Cancerous
here.
Area.
Yeah.
What it means is that they're not going to ban the substance, but it's going to require within 12 months that the Roundup bottles all have this warning label placed on them.
That says what? That there's an ingredient in here that doesn't cause cancer?
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Will that be on every bottle or just bottles meant for import to California?
Well, that's the problem, is that they don't have a state-by-state labeling system for their product. So they don't have a mechanism in place right now. It has gone through the first set of court battles, and Monsanto has come up on the downside of those results. It is going to appeals now, so we're going to see what eventually happens if they are successful at the appellate level of all of this. Interesting about the IARC, I was doing a little research on them. I got this from Wired magazine. They did a nice article on this. They are not supposed to make recommendations to the public. They assess the hazard, which is essentially scientific jargon, meaning something very different than risk.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And here's how they put it. If you have sharks, they like to use sharks as an example. If you have people gawking at sharks swimming around a tank in an aquarium, The sharks are a hazard. They pose little risk. If you have a surfer on the beach with a shark, that is both a hazard and a risk.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Okay. So that's how they summed it up as far as how you should be parsing this in as far as the terminology goes.
So sharks cause cancer? Wait, what?
Yes. I thought that they don't get cancer.
Yeah, shark cartilage.
So, but I don't even understand why a shark in a zoo would be a hazard.
Because it could potentially kill you, but it's not a risk because you're not in the tank with the shark.
Right.
Right? That's the idea. So glyphosate in doses that you'll never get exposed to could cause cancer, maybe, but you're not going to get exposed, so it's not really a risk.
Okay,
but
so it's a dose issue.
But the hazard is also not true.
Yeah.
So that's the other part of it.
So the shark really is nothing.
It's like saying a dolphin's a hazard. Well, it's not really even because you thought it was a shark. But
now there's a dolphin and a shark?
Yeah. So this is what happened with the IARC. There was, in fact, the scientist who was in charge of the review for the IARC of glyphosate they had completed the largest, epidemiological study to date, and they found that there was absolutely no correlation between glyphosate and cancer in people. But the data was, although it was complete, it had not been peer-reviewed and published. Yep. And the IARC said, well, we only use peer-reviewed data. So they didn't include that data, even though the guy making that decision did the study, which found the data that he knew showed that glyphosate didn't cause cancer.
Right.
And it's like, well, okay, it's not peer-reviewed, but like, aren't you guys scientists who are peer-reviewing these studies? I mean,
has it been peer-reviewed and published since then?
Yes. Yeah. So, but they didn't consider essentially definitive negative evidence and they also said, and we're not going to bother to update our recommendations. Even though now that, we didn't include it, we know about it, we're not going to update our recommendations. That's or whatever, our designations, not really recommendations, our designations.
Is there another, is it like 5 or 10 years they're going to do it
probably,
again?
Probably, yeah, whatever.
Just like didn't want to deviate from the protocol. Is glyphosate, so we always say glyphosate, which is Roundup, right? Is there, I'm assuming there's a patent on that, or is there off-brand?
The patent is off-patent.
So there is off-brand glyphosate now. So why are we always talking about Monsanto?
Yeah,
then?
Right. Most glyphosate is sold by manufacturers, not Monsanto.
Yeah,
I think, in fact, China is the number one producer of glyphosate in the world. But not that matters. But
no, it's just like everybody's always Monsanto and Roundup.
Well, that's because Monsanto is the villain, right? They're the villain du jour. So the thing is, I mean, the data that suggested that it may cause cancer was always really thin anyway. It is really based upon very, very weak data and only in farm workers and for non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But that is the data that was then, so that was really like a possibility, it's preliminary data. Mm-hmm. And then there was the follow-up data that said, nope, it's actually not a correlation there. And so it's done. Yeah. It really, the thing that's a killer is that glyphosate is probably one of the safest agrochemicals and certainly herbicides that there are. But they've decided to make it into like a scary toxin
so they could
demonize Monsanto.
Yeah.
But in fact, whatever would replace it is much more toxic than glyphosate is. There's nothing ironic about it. They don't care about the facts. It's like, this is here. We're going to scare people about this. In fact, they take like one of the safest things possible. So it really is crazy. And the IARC, I don't know that, that they were necessarily irresponsible in it getting out. I just think it's the anti-GMO people got a hold of that and then, disseminated it.
Right.
But didn't put it in context.
And they apparently have some very powerful lobbyists in the state of California because they were able to get this through and make it a law.
Yeah, and the California just has a really, really, really low bar, And in some ways, I think that has been beneficial historically. Like, I think in a lot of ways, California was the first to put really intense emission standards out and things like that. So, I mean, I guess I'm less concerned about the labeling than I am about the misperception there. I just think it comes down to an educational problem. Like, do individuals, people use weed killer all the time on their own property. Do they know that they're using glyphosate?
Mm-hmm.
Like, do they realize that when they're, like, spraying their yard with weed
killer? Probably not. Probably not.
I don't know where the intense fear comes from.
It's market. It's lobbying.
It's all marketing.
It's all propaganda. It's all anti-GMO propaganda.
And do you think that labeling initiative is propaganda?
Yes, absolutely. It's all anti-GMO propaganda. There's
What does the anti-GMO get out of this particular product? Like, what is the counter product?
They connect glyphosate to GMOs. That's why.
To the company that runs it.
Yeah,
right.
Because both of which came to Monsanto.
Right. Monsanto has
systems
and products that are very resistant.
That are glyphosate resistant, so that you can use glyphosate.
And this is even more severe a label, because historically the labeling initiatives that have passed in certain states about food that just say this food contains GMO products, we know it's not a warning label, but it's misconstrued as a warning label all the time. But this actually is a warning label.
Cancer.
Exactly.
That's a scare tactic.
And as a result, in reaction to the IARC designation, there is now a class action lawsuit against Monsanto for causing cancer from glyphosate exposure.
Oh, my God. Yep.
It's like the Johnson & Johnson thing.
Yeah. So, but it's baseless, but there it is. And then that becomes a propaganda point. I actually had a listener emailed us, and it's like, oh, you better rethink your defense of Monsanto. It's like, we don't defend Monsanto. We're just telling you what the science says. Yeah. And he linked to an article. It's like, okay, I'll click through, went to the article, and it was about this class action lawsuit, but it was like really anti Monsanto sort of piece. And I'm like, who is this? Is like not, this is clearly not like objective journalism. And so I researched the outlet, and it was literally, the outlet was Putin's propaganda arm. Like, it was basically, it's Moscow propaganda. Mm. And I sort of pointed this out to the listener. I'm like, you know, first of all, I'd give him some background on the issue. And the news item you linked to is actually Moscow. It's like Putin propaganda. And his response was, I don't care what they say, you know, I agree with what they say, basically.
Yeah, there you go.
So, because they have, it's all anti-American propaganda, right, which includes anti-corporate propaganda. And if I you're mean, into the anti-corporate propaganda, like, that's good.
Russia doesn't
but it resonates
like
with my idea.
I mean, think about how profoundly strange that is. Russia is campaigning against Monsanto's weed killer, for crying out loud.
They probably use it.
Yeah,
I mean,
they're drawing a line between that and some political influence somehow, but it's just
anti-capitalism.
That's
propaganda.
All it is. Yeah,
that's
but Monsanto is multinational. Yeah. You know what I mean? They're in a lot of countries. Yeah. Like this is utilized. And again, it has nothing to do with GMOs. So even in countries where GMOs are banned or in places where they only do certain types of farming, they can still use herbicides.
Yeah.
So they're probably using glyphosate.
You know, as a side note, I have Roundup in my garage, and I use it. It works great, by the way. And every time I use it, I get scared. I literally do. I'm just afraid to spray it on my foot, and I'm like, I know this is ridiculous, but I just can't help it because it sinks in. Like, I just have this innate fear of Roundup. But, man, it works really good.
Yeah, it sure does. Mm-hmm.
Like, I won't get rid of it, but I have this stupid, I have to deal with that stupid, irrational fear when I'm administering it, you know?
And that's the marketing.
Yeah.
It's gotten to you.
It's good
propaganda. It works.
Well, cancer is scary. I mean, it really resonates. You know, we know how dangerous it is.
All right, Jay, why don't you tell us how strong chimpanzees are?
Yeah, this is a fun one. Kara found this and thought it was a good match for me today. It is a question that I want to know the answer to. I mean, who would essentially win in a fight between a chimp and a human? And I'm just curious, in the audience, by a show of hands, raise your hand if you think
a
clap.
Do the one clap.
Do the single clap, like on three, if you think a human would win in a fight between a chimp. One, two, three. All right, two people.
Our species appreciates that very much. Yes.
Well, Jay, what kind of fight are we talking about?
I don't really know because this was what's funny.
Is it a cage match?
That is the news item's title.
Is it kickboxing?
No, but I think
it's wrestling. It's wrestling.
I mean, whatever it is, it doesn't involve tools.
It really boils down to this. It boils down to a physical feat of strength. So you could equate it to like punching and pulling and pushing
wrestling.
And a lot of wrestling type maneuvers because essentially that's what they were able to test here. So let me just give you the quickie. We do have, you know, the two people out of everyone here would think that a human could beat a chimpanzee. Most of us feel like they couldn't. Why? Why do we think that? Well, because we just, for some reason, it's in the collective consciousness. It's just out there. They just look strong.
There's the stories of like faces being eaten and all kinds of stuff.
Hands
like,
being ripped
hands
off.
Being
that
ripped off.
It's the
like,
violence.
Testicles being eaten by like pet monkeys and stuff. Like,
not good. Yeah,
not good. Not a good weekend.
Because I've always heard things like, well, yeah, chimps and gorillas are like 3 to 5 times stronger than a human.
Yeah.
And people say things like they would be playing with like a little bit, a baby chimp, and like, damn, you know, the chimp would squeeze a finger. Damn, that's really strong. And so that was kind of like the in the culture, like they are just they're a lot stronger. 3 to 5 was
the 5 times number comes from a 1920s biologist study. Right. So his name was John Bauman, and he studied chimps in the zoo. And now that they've have figured out that his studies were designed poorly, so they're like, okay, so the data isn't really reliable at this point. But he concluded that chimps were 5 times stronger than like what he described as a very powerful football player of the day.
Oh, we've just been thinking that this whole time because of this study.
That's when it slipped in. It's called the 1920s.
But their banana technology is so far advanced.
They do open it from the correct side.
Yeah.
We do not.
I try and I can't. I just mush it. It just turns into mush on me. I don't have those. There's like a finger thing. So to continue down, so like let's talk about what they were taught. Let's go into the activities that they were talking about. So pushing, pulling, lifting, and jumping. And humans are actually weaker or not as able to do these feats pound for pound. Okay. So an adult chimp is 100 pounds or 45 kilograms, where an adult human is what? Like, you know, 150 to 175 pounds on
average. An adult human male.
Human male. Yeah, if you'd average it out.
Is this male to male? Is that what they did?
I think they were doing male to male. And here are some answers. So they did a recent study and they found out that humans actually evolved about 7 million years ago. We started to evolve slow twitch muscles. And the slow twitch muscles are designed for endurance over, say, a power or, you know, fast movement or a powerful movement. And the reason,
I got to say, did the slow twitch fibers evolve then, or was there a pressure to develop more slow twitch?
I think from everything I read, it was a pressure to evolve more slow twitch.
It existed already. It was just the ratio that changed.
Yeah, the ratio started to significantly, for humans, go towards slow twitch.
Now, what's the difference between slow twitch and fast twitch?
I'm going to get there.
Okay.
Slow twitch muscles are, like I was saying, they're good for endurance, and they think that the reason why we evolved to have more slow twitch fibers in our muscle tissue is so we could travel much farther to get food, right? Yeah. So the way we got food wasn't fighting animals and stuff. It was going off and running far away and essentially increasing the perimeter of our food collection area.
Which is also why, you know, bipedalism is a huge advantage for that as well. Because bipedalism may not be very fast, but it's very efficient endurance-wise over long distance.
Right, it burns less calories as well. So humans can run marathons. We can run these long endurance feats where chimps wouldn't be able to make those types of activities. They couldn't sustain it.
Right, but even animals like horses eventually would lose to a human, right? Because they just don't have the endurance. That I've read that somewhere.
A conditioned human.
So scientists did have suspicions for a long time, though, that this data wasn't good. So recently, a research team went in and did the best kind of test that they can come up with. This was Matthew O'Neill, as an assistant professor at the University of Arizona College of Medicine in Phoenix. And he said, one of the advantages of our approach is that we avoid all the complexities involved in trying to elicit maximal performance from a chimpanzee of unknown motivation or interest, and instead get right to the measurement of the muscle tissue. And he's referencing the fact that they essentially use a microscope to compare the tissue side by side. And it's a cool point when you think, how do we measure the maximal effort that a chimpanzee can put in when you can't say, hey, we're doing a test, would you mind lifting as much weight over your head as you can? You can't do that. And, you know, so what do they do? They have to poke them with a stick and piss the chimpanzee to do these weird, you know, gestures and stuff. They just said, look, let's look at this, you know, on the muscle tissue level. Go down and look at the muscle cells and see what we find. There were other differences that I don't want to get into, because there's a lot of, like, protein differences and things like that, but you know, the summary is the muscle fibers were very, very similar. We just, as humans, have more of the slow twitch versus the fast twitch. Did it two times in a row. So let's put it to the table. 1.3 times stronger. That's where we're at now. Chimpanzees are 1.35 times stronger. Who would win in a fight? Now, wait.
No.
With no tools?
I'm not sure about that.
No, humans over time.
I'll tell you why. Well, there's a...
Yeah, but you've got to not die within that amount of time.
You're saying humans have a tactical advantage of some sort?
I don't think you will survive the first 10 minutes.
I would think that we have an incredible advantage with our minds, like with our ability to navigate through an encounter.
When they're eating your face off...
I think you're underestimating how smart chimpanzees are also.
They're smart. They're smart. But, I mean, I would like to think if a person can dodge, you know, like a velociraptor attack, they can dodge a chimpanzee attack. It was in the movie, I saw it.
Yeah. Well, why don't we actually look at historical documentation? How often has a human being found themselves in a chimpanzee enclosure and survived?
Yeah, Bob. You're right.
Yes.
You're right. I guess that's awesome.
There must be some data on that somewhere.
I would think that it would be extraordinarily dangerous, but I just don't know. I'm not sold yet. I have to see the cage match.
But keep in mind, though, that there is a lot of variation within people. So you could have marathon runners who have a preponderance more slow twitch, sprinters who have much more fast twitch. So there is still a lot of variation, but in general.
But the question was, who would win in a fight, not who would win a race.
I don't even like that question.
I know. It is.
They're stronger. They're 1.3 times stronger. That's it. Yeah. I mean, with skill, technique, martial arts, a human will, you know, could kick their butt.
Like, could, what, yeah, Bruce Lee would probably kick a monkey's ass, right?
Ape.
Yeah, but not Bruce Chip.
I'm sorry.
not Bruce Chip. Yeah.
When you look at, like, UFC fighters, they're not big guys. They're cut. They're really trim, but they're not, like, bodybuilder. Yes. Cliched, wide-chested, huge muscles kind of guys.
Yeah.
Those guys are probably stronger than the UFC guys, but the UFC guys have stamina and strength.
So I think and technique.
Yeah. And technique. So I think like a human monkey fight, the monkey would have the strength. Chimp would have the strength coming in. But if a human could make it through that initial barrage and endure.
But also, like, we have rules of engagement that chimps don't have. Mm-hmm. So they're going to play super dirty.
They're going to fight very dirty.
Yeah, they'll fling all
sorts
of stuff.
They're going to fling poop in your face.
That's very chimpish to me. I'm sorry.
That the Queensbury rules don't apply to a chimp. I don't know. I think it's very chimpish.
But you can go Mike Tyson on his ass, though, chimp.
Bite his ear off. Bite his ear off. Oh, my God. So we still don't know. Maybe it might end up on YouTube somewhere. We'll see.
By the way, do you know what determines whether a muscle fiber is type 1 or type 2, fast twitch or slow twitch?
I thought it was there's a protein change.
Well, it's different, but what determines?
Oh, what thing makes, we're going to make slow twitch.
Mitochondria.
You're saying how do we identify the difference or what in development turns
they,
one
they
on?
They stain differently. That's why you tell the difference. It's what determines.
What is it?
If that fiber is type 1 or type 2, what determines it?
What?
It's the nerve that innervates it. That's it. And if you change the nerve that innervates it, it switches from one to the other.
Yeah. How can you change the nerve?
Well, I'll tell you.
Okay.
So let's say you have nerve damage, right? And so normally you have like a mosaic of type 1 and type 2 fibers. But if you have nerve damage and then the nerves that are surviving will cross sprout and pick up the muscle fibers that have been left behind, then you get fiber type grouping because now you have a nerve fiber is picking up the surrounding denervated muscle fibers. Then you get these big clusters of type 1 and type 2. So they just flip to whatever nerve innervates them.
So it's the hormones
from the nerve.
Your wrist could be like have super endurance.
Well,
yeah, could. Yeah, could, Jay. Imagine.
Mostly
imagine
men laughed at that joke.
Keep practicing, Jay.
Well, Steve was showing this.
So Steve.
No, but wait, I'm not done. Is that what happens, though, for real? Like, you could all of a sudden be really strong in your arm because some weird thing happened?
No, you're probably not going to end up stronger after you recover from nerve damage.
No. Okay. It could be a cool superhero origin, though, in the making, right? Some electrical thing happens. Yeah.
So is there a default?
His name is Twitch. Yeah.
Is there a default type? Like if you denervate and then you have muscle wasting after that, does it switch back to a different type or?
No. Well, no, if you denervate, it just fades away and dies. Yeah, it dies. Yeah. It takes a while. But when you reinnervate it, it just becomes whatever.
I mean, it would make sense, right? Fast twitch versus slow.
Well, the nerves keep it alive.
So the nerve keeps it alive.
The nerve determines whether it tells it
its input and how often it should be used.
But
so
I think
then
over time that muscle would somehow develop. I don't know. Somehow develop a specific. Specificity that
well,
would
it
be,
probably does over time. It probably the myoglobin changes, the mitochondria might change, but it's just saying it's not permanent.
Wow. It's not permanent.
Yeah. So that's why if you damage your spine and no more nerve activity is happening, your muscles just slowly atrophy and go away.
Well, you were ambiguous in saying that because the spine has both upper and lower motor neuron in it. So the difference is if I damage your brain and your left arm is paralyzed, but the nerves are there, it'll get disuse atrophy, but it won't get denervation atrophy. So we'll get a little bit of atrophy. But if I cut the nerve and your arm can't work, now it has no nerve supply, it'll waste away to nothing.
Right. And even if you electrically stimulate the muscle or anything,
it's not the electrical stimulation. They thought that for years and that was really a hard idea for people to get rid of because it's just something so sexy about the notion that you could, shock the muscle and it will work. But it just does nothing for it. It's the hormones from the nerve that it's actively secreting into the muscle. And without that, electrical stimulation doesn't
work. What about artificial hormones?
Yeah, we've tried that too. And it works. It does something, but it's just not the same.
So we need a good artificial nerve, basically.
Yeah.
We've got to be able to come up with one that has a chemical and an electrical.
Like in ALS, for example, we did exactly that. We gave the artificial hormone and it bulks them up a little bit, but it doesn't keep them from dying.
Right. Now, what if you take it when you're normal? Would you bulk up even more?
Yeah.
So,
okay. Interesting.
See, right. Then you could fight the chimp.
We're on to something.
So Twitch, the superhero, electrical accident, and he's bulking up on this hormone.
He must have fallen into a vat.
So he has like a 10% improvement.
He fell in a
Hey, that can help.
He's a minimal superhero.
You know, he's an ex-athlete. He's a former Olympian.
Yep.
who fell into a vat of nerve endings.
That's what it said on the label, nerve endings.
Not big nerve beginnings, nerve endings.
Look at me, I'm Stan Lee!
All right, George, while we're on this theme of athletic performance, tell us about the marathon.
It's like everything we're just talking about is sort of in this story. So May 26th, this past year, was the 63rd anniversary of, anybody know?
I won't say anything.
You probably had it. It was the 4-minute mile.
Yeah. Roger Bannister.
Very good. Yeah. Yes. After the question is answered, but that's good. Half a point. Yes, it was the 63rd anniversary of the first time that the 4-minute mile was broken for years, for decades. It was thought that no one would ever run faster than a 4-minute mile. It just seemed this impossibility. And then it was done, and now high schoolers are breaking 4-minute miles because that's the way sports work.
Seriously, high schoolers are doing that?
I think so. It's incredible. Like you look at the times of swimmers from the Olympics in the 30s. It's like you don't even get to states anymore with those times in terms of high schools and college.
When I run an 8-minute mile, I feel like I'm dead. I've just died.
These people
it's horrible.
Crazy. It's crazy. Yeah. Wow. So to celebrate that, the sneaker company Nike put together sort of a program where they wanted to beat 2-hour marathon. So the world record for a marathon is 2 hours and 2 minutes. It's 2 hours, 2 minutes and 57 seconds.
And
so,
what is that? 26.
26.2 miles. 26.2 miles. And Steve told me a really interesting thing. Do you want to say the thing you told me?
Well, just a trivia question. Yeah. What is that distance? Why is it 26.2 miles?
That was the distance that the person ran that ran from something to marathon, right?
Marathon to Athens.
Marathon to Athens. That was it.
And then, yeah.
What did he say when he got there?
My sneakers, they suck. I don't know what.
Close.
He died. Didn't he die?
Well, I think that's a myth. He dropped dead.
Well, he eventually died.
But he allegedly also said Nike, which means victory, which is what he was reporting on.
Did he know?
What the shoe was named after.
Shit.
Yeah, cool though. So so the guy says Nike and drops dead.
Yeah. Maybe not.
And that took hours and hours and hours. So there's been, much like the 4-minute mile, there was this kind of idea that we're never going to break a 2-hour, 26.2 mile race. Now, to do that, you would have to run 13.1 miles an hour for 2 hours. So think about that. Like, you know, when you go to the gym and you're on the treadmill and you're like at 5 miles, 6, 7, maybe 8 miles. If you get up to 8 miles an hour, you are cooking. Yeah. These guys would have to run at 13 miles plus an hour for 2 hours straight.
So you need a lot of that fast twitch.
That's the thing. Yeah, yeah, which is interesting.
We'll find a 26-mile downhill stretch and just run down that hill.
That raises all these issues. So Nike said, how can we do this? Let's think about the science of it and let's see if we can make conditions that would be perfect. So yes, we're going to fabricate this on a certain level, but we're not going to fabricate it to the point where it's super cheating. We'll try to recreate the situation, the conditions that you would have in a race, and we'll sort of try to modify as best as we can. So what does that mean? Well, we have a pace car. We'll try to make different shoes, of course, because it's Nike. You know, some said that this was basically just a big sneaker commercial, which it was, but they legitimately were trying to sort of create these shoes. So they developed these new shoes that they've used carbon fiber plates in shoes. So you have your foam and you have your
carbon fiber.
NASA carbon fiber, exactly. Yes, just like, right.
Yeah.
It's like goop. Yeah. They somehow designed, what was the thing? Yeah, it says here, for every 100 grams in a shoe, an elite marathon runner loses 1%. Of their sort of speed and time for every 100 grams in a shoe. So if you can make the shoes like incredibly light, 1% over a 2-hour race makes a huge difference when you're talking about, you know, minutes of time or seconds of time.
What if they just don't wear shoes?
Well, that's the thing. The advantage is that you do get this sort of spring thing and it does preserve the ankles. They got to find that balance. So they first designed these shoes that had no heels on them because a lot of these elite runners run on the balls of their feet. They run at the front of the balls of their feet. But it freaked the runners out because they had these shoes that looked like some Lady Gaga thing or something. It was just like, that's just freaking us out. We can't do that. So they designed these shoes and they put the carbon fiber in between the foam and it leaned forward a little bit. So in essence, it sort of made it like you were running downhill, you know, it's like a 1% difference or a 0.5% difference, but over time. So they got this guy. His name is, Eliud Kipchoge. He's a Kenyan. And they sort of picked him. Of course. Don't be racist. They picked him. They picked him and two other runners and decided to sort of train him because he sort of had the conditions that were right. They wanted to figure, they were going to call the thing Project Able, they thought, all right, we're going to call this Project Able. It's going to be like this sub-2-hour marathon thing. And then someone said Project Able was what, when they first launched monkeys into space, was called Project Able. And someone said, you know, a bunch of white scientists with Kenyans? So to their credit, they said, burp. So they called it Breaking 2, and that was the project. So Nike's Breaking 2.
That's
a much cooler name. Much cooler name. So they had to find a track, and they said, okay, what do we do? Do we do a straight single shot with no turns? Because turns eat up a little bit of time. Mm-hmm. And they realized, well, we can't do that, because then to provide water, to provide the carbs and all that stuff, and the basic coaching and the sort of support, you would have to have guys in trucks and chasing them, so it's better to have a curve.
That's
so
that bad. They can, that's dumb. Why couldn't they do that?
Oh, because it's just, I don't know.
They need a truck, and that's like too much for them to overcome.
In terms of the influence, like getting close to someone with a truck while they're running, you don't want to be drafting, because then it's a drafting issue that enters into
but couldn't
it.
Couldn't they just have people post it up?
Maybe.
Nike didn't think
write them a letter.
They clearly should have hired you.
Again, it's 26 miles, so yeah.
They would need a straight shot of 26
that's
miles
the thing.
Of track.
That's
difficult.
Yeah, so they found a place in Monza, Italy, which is the Autodromo Nazionale Monza, which is a racetrack, which was just perfect. Mm-hmm. It was just perfect. It was a very sort of long stretch, had nice two turns to it, and they could maintain stuff, they could do things. They decided we're going to have an electric Tesla, drive in front of the runners, but far enough away so that they're not drafting off of it. Okay. It was going to project into the street this laser grid that basically would say, like, if you're in this area, you're on pace.
Oh, you know, fascinating. Kind of like
that's really cool.
Cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was also a clock. On top of the car also that was going to have a countdown thing, because they were shooting for 1:59:59. That's what they wanted, 1:59:59. So they also provided other runners. There were 30 other runners that would act as pacers and guys to provide wind resistance for drafting. Because that's something that happens in races. When you have these races, guys run in front. And again, it's not so much that the runner runs faster, but they conserve energy. They run at the same pace, but it's less effort. So that when you get to the end of the race, you have more reserves and you can finish this thing.
So the people that are out front are probably not going to be the...
Oh yeah, no, they're sacrificed. They know your job is to just get in front of the guys and you act as a windbreak in essence. Mm-hmm. So they get behind you. It's the same thing happens in cycle races, the same deal. Mm-hmm. Like guys are on the team, they know we're not going to win, but we are part of the team that provides the break and air resistance. It's really cool.
I'm so excited to hear what happens.
I know. So they started this race at 5 a.m.
George, I have a quick question.
Yeah.
Did they, I would suspect that they would have brought the runners to a higher elevation for a few weeks or a month, so they...
Well, that was part of the issue of like how much do we now influence the how much do we affect this? Because we could do a track that's totally downhill and we could do it. Yeah. We could blow fans on the guys that are running to cool them down, or even behind them to provide them with some like a breeze, quote unquote. Yeah. We're like, oh, let's figure out what would be a legitimate breeze that might happen at a race, and we'll do that. Mm. The guys the people that were creating this at Nike sort of wanted to make it as they cheat as much as they possibly could while still somewhat maintaining the realistic
They're simulating the real race.
So like they're not saying this is a real race, they're not saying whatever. But so yeah, this idea of the blood doping, and I think being Kenyan, he already runs at elevations and does stuff. So
okay,
maybe there might have been a concern about that. So they started at 4 a.m. and everything was going great. And Eliud was kicking butt, and he went for an hour, and at an hour he was completely on pace. And in an hour and a half, he was completely on pace.
Yes.
And he got to about 4.5 miles from the end. He was doing okay, but they noticed that his running style changed a little bit. He had this thing that when he was really cooking and he was really feeling good, his thumbs would rub as if he had lapels. His thumbs would kind of rub on his shirt, and his hands were starting to kind of get away from his chest. And they thought, oh, he's starting to break down. And his pace started going. The car started getting a little bit further in front of him. He ran as hard as he could, and he finished at 2:25.
Oh, they're on the right track, though. I mean,
so they're definitely on the right track. They're saying the problem is exactly that slow twitch thing. Mm-hmm. There is only so much glycogen reserve that you can sort of have. So the muscles reserve this sort of glycogen, and you're trying to trying to not get to that lactic acid burn. You know, when you do repeated exercises, you get that burning sensation. And that's death for a distance athlete of any kind. So you want to prevent that as best as you can. So they do all kinds of carbo loading. They do all kinds of stuff. They're already, you know, being sort of genetically perfect for this type of race. He already has the slow twitch stuff, but they're worried that it's just,
human.
There might be this point.
Yeah,
where
but 25 seconds.
26
seconds. There's someone out there that can do it.
26 seconds.
He could probably do it. I mean, this is the first time he ever tried.
Yeah, I'm sure that they could. Right. That was so close, it's ridiculous.
He must have been so pissed.
Yeah.
He apparently was out. Because, I mean, now here's the thing. He beat the world record by a minute and 40 seconds.
Yeah, so he still beat the record.
Which is kind of incredible.
But does it count?
Well,
because he's not actually running.
It doesn't count as a race.
No, but he did train his ass off, so he probably will break the record in a normal race.
So somebody who's that fit... Yeah. Who is doing a race like this, like trains and trains and trains and then does it, like, is that bad for you? Like, does he have a lot of recovery after? Does it make him sick? Does it cause like pretty severe injury to your knees?
No, they're amazed at how resilient these guys are, especially these long distance guys. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are people that do 100-mile races. There are people that do multiple marathons on multiple days.
Yeah, right.
And the elite ones, there's something about the physiology of theirs that it's incredible.
Kind of feel better
about
myself. I know. Like a trade-off.
There was one thing I forgot to mention that they said the ideal conditions for running a race where it's not too hot, not too cold, because you want it to be cool enough so that your body's sort of efficient, but not so cold that you're trying to heat yourself, is like 51, 52 degrees. And apparently in Italy right there, it was like 54. So they were saying like, ooh, so maybe like if we got 1 or 2 degrees cooler, we could...
every little drop.
That's the thing. But again, like at that point, at that level, it's every little bit that you can do.
26 freaking seconds.
26 seconds,
the people that paid for this thing were like, oh, my God, right there.
But again, it was this idea of this is research. Like, you know, what are we doing? And now there's, I think, two other shoe companies are doing a very similar thing. And it might happen. Maybe they'll do the straight shot and no turns.
I'm surprised Red Bull hasn't done this. Mm. They have like an elite athlete lab, basically, in California where they
didn't
do
they
a lot
do
of this
the,
kind of stuff.
The guy who dropped from
Felix Baumgartner. Yeah, that was Red Bull. So it's like they do this marketing stuff, but it is also like there's legit research that happens at the lab.
Yeah. What's funny is 2 hours is a completely arbitrary time.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Well, and yet it just happens to coincide with what the limit is.
It might be psychological, like the 4 minute mile.
That was my idea.
Once one person breaks two.
They should lie to him and say someone beat the 2 minute mile. Seriously, it is a mental barrier.
It really is. But the thing is, I think 25 seconds over 26 miles is trivial. So I think someone's clearly going to beat that. Mm-hmm. But what I think though, but there is some biomechanical limit. There is some limit that humans can never. So maybe it's an hour and 55 minutes. No human is ever going to cross that. You know, it's hard to calculate.
I don't know, Bob.
There is a point where you just, no human.
But wait, without just with genetic variability, over time, there's always going to probably be someone that could have, you know, shave a couple of seconds.
So, but then you're saying that where's the cutoff? Like, nobody's going to run a marathon in 12 minutes. That's impossible. Yeah. You know what I mean? So there has to be a cutoff.
At some point, there's going to be some cutoff where there's no the genetic variability can't
I get
do
what
it.
You're saying. Like,
augmentation, you won't be human anymore. That type of thing. But what is that number? It's interesting to think that there is that number somewhere.
Yeah.
For any race, 100-yard dash, whatever, it's all...
The mental thing, though, is fascinating because every record that you see, the big records, like any Olympic sort of thing, long jump, I mean, forever, that was the 26, 25 feet or whatever it was, like no one could beat that. And then that time in Mexico and whatever, the 76 or 72, when the guy went like 27 feet or whatever, and it was like, oh, okay.
Was that just, in 68? Was that the Olympics in Mexico? That was 68?
I think so, 68, yeah, okay, but the guy
Panther
did. The guy was like, he broke the record by 2 feet or some crazy number. And it happens again and again that sort of all of these things kind of fall away. So maybe in 50 years, like the 2 hour elite, you know, marathon will be, oh, okay, yeah. It'll be like the 4 minute mile.
You're talking about these big time differences, decades, right? Yeah. Decades ago, people thought the 4 minute mile. Right. Decades ago. Think about all of the background technology that has improved within those decades. Like the medicine, the nutrition science.
Training.
Video assist and computer stuff.
I mean,
and
it's not just obviously psychological. People who want to be healthier are healthier now. Yeah. People who are striving for that have more available to them.
Yeah. I mean, I see this all the time on YouTube with like, you know, 7-year-old guitarists that are monsters. And you just go, Like, how? And you're going to realize, oh, well, wait a minute. Okay, yeah, the instruments are better, the availability is better, the teaching's better, the coaching's better.
They knew to start practicing earlier.
Yeah, and the availability of types of lessons and stuff. Not to take away anything from someone's diligent work, but, and it's not just like it's a outlier. There's one kid. There's hundreds of kids.
Yeah.
And same thing with athletes. You just get these athletes because the coaching is better. Everything is
better. And they're scouted when they're so young.
And there's 7.5 billion people in the world. Right. How many people were there in the world 100 years ago?
Yeah.
I get that, but I also think, Gio, do you think that kid was predisposed to be able to do that? Or do you think it's just the time in?
No, I think because it's too prevalent. I think there's way too many examples. I think, you have outliers and you have sort of predisposed, pre-geniuses that could take advantage of whatever conditions they have. But I just think that the training and the equipment and the coaching is so...
Okay.
And I say that, you can coach yourself now.
But you also can't separate the two.
Yeah.
You just can't.
Yeah,
there's too much interaction between the nature.
Yeah, but don't forget,
nature.
When you're looking at for examples of extreme human performance, when you get to that wall, you're going to need the optimal genetic profile to do it.
Optimal everything.
Yeah,
everything,
but also the optimal training protocol.
All of it needs to be. All of it.
I love
the weather.
The Jerry Seinfeld bit where he talks about the runners, how like between first place and eighth place is like, this is first and this is eighth. Dead last. First place, dead last. Like, best in the world, want to kill yourself. This is whole bit. And it's so true. Like at that point, it's like hundreds of a second, 100 meter dash or whatever.
I bet you I know how we could shave those last 26 seconds off.
How, Steve?
You got to put a sticker on them that has vibrational energy. And it will
segue,
right,
there.
Kara? Yeah. Won't that work?
I like that segue. Yeah. Nice. So, this news article was trending kind of towards the end of last week. So, who has heard about these Goop stickers? I see. Yeah, there's a lot of people in the audience.
Who's wearing a Goop sticker?
Yeah. Who has a body vibe on right now? Okay. So, this company is called Body Vibes, and they were actually.
But they only work on supermodels.
They only apparently.
That's right.
Yeah. Apparently, they only work on supermodels. And Body Vibes is being promoted on Goop, which is, of course, Gwyneth Paltrow's lifestyle brand, who brought to you the Jade Vagina Egg.
What is a lifestyle brand?
It's a money-making empire, is what it is.
We need an SGU lifestyle brand.
That's
a way to get very wealthy people to buy your crap. That's what it means.
And so this Body Vibes company was actually formed around... technology, I'm using this really loosely, technology by a company called Alpha Biocentrics. And so I'm going to get to Alpha Biocentrics soon because I think that's where the real story is. But first, let's talk about the Goop story.
What can we name this company which will just scream bullshit?
Yes, yes, exactly.
What could we possibly... Alpha Biocentrics. That's awesome.
So Steve wrote about this. So did Gizmodo did a great write-up on these stickers. And originally, if you go to Goop's website now and you read about the sticker, some stuff has been pulled because so many people brought to their attention. But originally, they claimed that this sticker used, quote, NASA spacesuit material in it. And their claim was that this was the same material in spacesuits, this carbon material that helped read the biometric data of NASA astronauts. And, of course, NASA said, we don't... do that. Like, we don't have that technology. And also, there is no carbon in spacesuits at all. And if there
so
were
they just
carbon,
made it up.
They just made it up. If there were carbon in spacesuits, it would be there to add strength. It would not be there for, like, energy frequency readings. And so I want to read you what some of the claims are on the stickers. If we actually look at the Goop website, it says the concept... human bodies operate at an ideal energetic frequency. But everyday stresses and anxiety can throw off our internal balance, depleting our energy reserves and weakening our immune systems. Body Vibe stickers come pre-programmed to an ideal frequency, allowing them to target imbalances. While you're wearing them, close to your heart, on your left shoulder or arm, they'll fill in the deficiencies in your reserves, creating
I like how they throw in those random details to make
like
it seem real.
Make sure you put it here.
Make sure you put it within 3 inches of your whatever.
Well, and they also, later on, if you dig around the website, like, how soon will it work? It's like different bodies resonate differently. So some of you will feel it within a few hours, but we recommend wearing them for at least a month, right? Because you only get 10 in a pack for $60. So that means you have to buy three packs in order to do that. Yeah. So, and apparently they can help clear your skin, too. They have, so when you look at the different...
Read the title. The title of the piece.
Oh, which piece? Just wearable stickers that promote healing, parenthesis. Really? Exclamation point.
Like, even then, it's bullshit.
Yeah, that's not true.
Really?
So...
This unbelievable claim?
And so if you go to the website to, shop for Body Vibes, they have all these different kinds. They have Hydrate, a 10-pack of Hydrate. I mean, you could drink water, but that's cool. They have Anti-Anxiety. They have a Hangover 10-pack, a Self-Love 10-pack.
Oh, they're really going for it.
Yeah. Mental Focus.
Ooh, they got a Fast Twitch sticker. That's
cool. Right? Yeah. And so, because it's...
They have a gullibility one?
Gullibility, yeah, right?
Sold out.
That one works.
I think that's the self-love 10-pack. Yeah. And so the thing is...
Where do you put that one?
$60. It'll tell you if you click through.
Yeah, right.
Anywhere you want.
This one says, for courage, healing, and self-confidence, empower yourself. Like, those are the instructions. Yeah. That's all you get.
The instructions.
But the scary thing about this is that...
People buy it.
I mean, it's scary because, yes, we talk a lot about pseudoscience and hucksterism and how, you know, these companies or individuals even take advantage of gullible people. And a lot of times it really just is about taking advantage of their wallet. And there's a part of everybody that I think has, a schadenfreude in them that's like... Yes. These goop shoppers deserve it. But at the same time, I want to remember that this isn't just it's a hangover 10-pack. Like, there is a hangover 10-pack. It's like you put it on and I feel better after my hangover. There are ones called Anti-Anxiety. There's one called...
That's scary.
It's scary. There's one called Mood Boost that says promotes a positive outlook and balances mood swings. I don't know about you, but I don't think that somebody with bipolar disorder should be using a sticker to try and improve their mental functioning. So I think this does actually move over into that area of danger. First things first, they claim that there's NASA spacesuit material. Gizmodo writes about it, asks NASA for comment. NASA comes back, and actually NASA doesn't come back right away, but there's an previous NASA science lead who they interviewed who no longer works at NASA. Sometimes it's easier to get comments from people because otherwise they have to go through their PR people. And his comment was, quote, what a load of BS this is. Wow, what a load of BS this is. So... he's the one who clarified NASA doesn't put carbon in their spacesuits. Goop has since pulled the claim regarding NASA from its website. And then the company Body Vibes said, quote, this is their kind of retraction claim. And this really pisses me off. We apologize to NASA, Goop, our customers, and our fans for this communication error. It's just an error. We never intended to mislead anyone. Yeah, you did. We've learned that our engineer was misinformed by a distributor about the material in question. Here's the thing. Which was purchased for its unique specifications. Yet, they go on and say, we regret not doing our due diligence before including the distributor's information in the story. However, the origins of the material do not any way impact the efficacy of our product. Right. Body Vibes remains committed to offering a holistic lifestyle tool, and we stand by the quality and effectiveness of it. You can't have it both ways.
You can have it both ways.
Yes, you can.
They just did, apparently. Yeah. And so I wanted to dig a little bit deeper, and I looked into Alpha Biocentrics, and oh man, the things they sell are amazing. Okay, they sell a patch, an antioxidant patch. They sell a prostate care patch. Hello, dangerous.
How is the antioxidant still a thing?
Yeah. They sell a patch that's designed to reduce the symptoms of an enlarged prostate. So yeah, that's not dangerous at all.
Well, speaking of the antioxidant thing, it was funny. Mm-hmm. I was looking for stuff to post on Facebook, and there was a news item that I was like, should I post this or not? It was about Chinese researchers who genetically engineered a purple rice.
Yes.
Yes, but it's high in antioxidants.
Yes.
And I couldn't find anything about it that didn't declare how it was high in antioxidants. So I'm like, do I go with the GM or the antioxidant hype?
It's too much.
I decided not to post
it. It's too much. Yeah, that's an easy go-to. So they do a lot of this antioxidant bullshit on there.
Oh, apparently, oh, sorry, I love this. It's just an endless supply. On the Body Vibes website, now remember, this is the company that actually markets the stickers. Our bodies operate at an optimal internal frequency. Sweet spot in the neighborhood of 62 to 72 hertz.
Yeah.
They're not the only company that has said this.
Studies have shown that when our frequency slips, our immune system's compromised, which opens the door
to getting sick. Where's the study? Did they cite the study?
No, they didn't cite the study. Come on. There's actually a whole science and technology page.
Whoa. Yeah, that has no study.
That has no science or technology in it. It just talks about how they're performance driven, how Alpha Biocentrics pioneered bioenergy synthesis technology. Using a one-of-a-kind device, an accelerator frequency generator. I mean, that sounds like a turbo.
Guys, why doesn't the government shut them down? Why don't we have an agency that just shuts this crap down?
Okay, here's the thing. Alpha Biocentric, super dangerous. So you can look at all these things. They sell, like, medallions that balance your chakras and stuff. But the one that I found that is, like, incredible is the Digestive Solution Energy Card. Ooh. And it looks like a credit card. It even has the strip on the back.
Yeah.
You guys. Ah, okay.
If you swipe it in your ass, what do you do?
No. It's even better. Are you ready? Instructions. Place the Digestive Solution Energy Card under your food plate for 20 to 25 seconds.
Oh my God.
And then place your beverage for the same amount of time. Your body will receive the bioenergetic signatures from the energy card. The energy card is guaranteed for 2 years.
Yes. Guaranteed for what?
Yeah, it says, no
it
lie.
It won't fall apart?
The first sentence, the Digestive Solution Energy Card is made for human carbon units. You can now boost your body's energy signature by placing this Digestive Solution Energy Card under your food plate and the beverage of your choice and receive energy back from the card instantly. The energy card has a magnetic strip embedded in the back that holds digitally enhanced information that once your food or beverage comes in contact with it, the energy is delivered immediately to the food and beverage, thereby boosting the energy to your food to maximize the nutrition you consume.
Digitally enhanced information.
Carbon units. Win a Nobel Prize for that.
They sell this. I mean, people purchase this. And then they go to restaurants and they put it under their water bottle for 20 seconds and then they have more water nutrition when they drink it.
You know what that reminds me of? You just made me think of, you ever see the wine card?
Yeah.
The wine credit card thing? Yeah. So this is a derivative of the wine
credit
card.
Well, it's a derivative really of that, you know, they blew the cover off of the dealer out of the UK who sold basically these dousing rods.
We've talked about that before on the show.
But why isn't this fraud?
It is fraud. Yeah. And how is it that it's
what about the prostate
available
stuff?
Available on their website. How is it that the FDA hasn't shut this down?
Isn't the prostate thing, isn't that diagnosing something? I mean, isn't that
well, because it probably says on the thing, just like any vitamin, this is not intended to diagnose, treat.
Yeah,
it says it on the stickers. It has that little...
You know what's it?
But then right above it, it says, this will, you know, shrink your prostate.
And even if anyone took them to task, the government, the state, or people, right, they would be sued, and they would be sued for about a hundth of what they made.
Yeah.
Right. Wouldn't even come close to shutting
down. Right.
You're due to some weird circumstance, you're at a dinner with Gwyneth Paltrow. What do you say to her? Like you're at a table, you know you got about 30 minutes, you can probably talk to her, and you want to be nice about it, and like how do you be nice about it?
Gwyneth Paltrow.
No, I mean, like, you know.
You can find videos online of Gwyneth Paltrow being interviewed by like late night talk show hosts where she's like, I don't know how any of this crap works.
Like, yeah, she's all but admitted saying.
Yeah, she's like, I curate the website. Different people write about it. I think everybody should have the opportunity to.
She lends her name and celebrity to these products and ideas.
When you ask her to use them, she's like, no, I don't
know really about
her. How would you approach her?
How do you sleep at night? I guess is what I would say to you.
That would be the question for me. It would be, you know, if I was able to get into a real conversation.
She puts one of those cards under her pillow for 20 minutes before she gets into bed.
Because I've been in a situation where.
You're saying. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I've been in a situation where I'm face to face with a Hollywood celebrity at a dinner party, and we're talking about these kinds of things. And it is very. I'm not there to, you know, change their mind in 20 seconds. I can't do that, and I don't want to be contentious and start a fight. And so, it's really I think about asking questions.
Yeah,
a lot of
times that's where you start.
Yeah,
and you build on that.
Why do you do this? Or like what things on your website do you use? And then you start saying things like. you know, do you think that some people might be taken advantage by this? Mm. And, maybe, but at the same time.
Aren't, it's that passive-aggressive question. Aren't you concerned about selling pseudoscience to people?
She's not stupid. She knows she's making a boatload of money off of this. And when you ask her about grounding, which is earthing, they advocate, which is walking around without your shoes on to get like energy frequencies out of the dirt, she's like, that's dumb. Like, she'll say things. Like, there are plenty of videos online where she's like, I don't buy into a lot
of
this stuff.
I would get her to listen to the SGU. Maybe that would help a bit. Mm.
Eventually.
Maybe we should start our own lifestyle brand
This is where I have a very hard time, because there's malfeasance here. Mm-hmm. It is horribly taking advantage of people, and probably, the typical thing is people aren't going to the doctor or receiving legitimate treatments, and they're doing this total crap is like not servicing humanity in a positive way.
But, talking to Gwyneth Paltrow, I don't think it's going to change that. I think what's going to change it, because this is actually a moral question more than it's a legal question. I'm sure that Goop's lawyers do a good job of making sure that the disclaimers are in the bottom of the articles. Obviously, these products all have the same disclaimers that vitamins and supplements have to have. So really, the question is, are the laws strict enough?
Are we doing enough? That's not a question.
The right angle is educating the populace.
And advocating politically for changing the legislation.
Yeah.
I think we have to be more involved there as well.
Yeah, fraud is fraud, you would think.
But this technically, I don't think, is construed as...
They're making structure function claims. If you notice all the claims where it boosts this, it enhanced that, it lines your whatever. They didn't say it cures a disease. They didn't mention any diseases by name. So if they do that and they have the disclaimer, the what we call the quack Miranda warning, this doesn't actually work, but whatever, then technically they're within the letter of the law they're selling it as a supplement, dietary supplement, health and education act. And then the FTC might go after them if they think that they're misleading claims, if they're making misleading commercial claims. The FTC is actually more aggressive and has more power than the FDA at this point. But even then, just they don't have enough, really don't have the resources and the power to really, to monitor this kind of stuff and deal with it. So absolutely the regulations need to change. But the political will isn't there. It is amazing though. When I wrote about it, I focused mainly, because it's, I don't need to tell people that's bullshit. Anyone's reading my book.
Obviously bullshit.
It was mainly, how is it that people would buy this? What is going on in someone's head where they think they could put a sticker on their arm and it's going to realign their body vibrations and whatever? And it is a combination of scientific illiteracy, because you got to be pretty clueless about how the universe works to think that, but also a complete lack of critical thinking skills.
It's and I think you're missing out a third tier that I see a lot in Hollywood, which is... So it's a lack of critical thinking skills, and the blind spot's a sacred cow. Why do otherwise intelligent people, because sometimes they do have good critical thinking skills, but they still fall victim.
Compartmentalization.
And they do compartmentalize, and yes, maybe their science literacy is low, even though their political literacy is quite high. But I think a lot of it is fundamental distrust of some sort of system. Mm-hmm, I think you see that a lot. These people that think that the pharmaceutical industry
but
is
you trust
you.
These guys?
Exactly.
That's the thing. Why would you trust them?
Because since there are no regulations on how they market this stuff, they can say and do whatever they want, and they seem like the alternative.
But that's the marketing aspect of it.
The alternative medicine umbrella is so attractive to
you. But it's also the language thing, though. You go to this, and you kind of read this mumbo-jumbo, but it kind of makes sense. You look at the warning on the back of an ad for Zyrtec. It's this page of stuff because they have to.
Because they're playing by the rules.
They're actual rules. You're going to go, why would I want to put this in my body when I can have this in my body?
And so there's just something about having an alternative to the mainstream. I mean, the rhetoric that I hear all the time from my friends in LA, who are these pound the pavement, anti-GMO, pro-natural, pro-organic people, is that the complex out there, big food and big medicine, wants to keep you sick so they can keep selling you their products. Yeah. And that's their goal, right? And so if we can come in with an alternative treatment that works, and then these alternative treatments are the definition of pseudoscience, because they, of course, use scientific-sounding terminology.
Yeah,
I mean, it's all bullshit. The writer of the Gizmodo article called it what would happen if you put Enya lyrics in a blender. Or it's like that Chopra. You guys have seen that great Deepak Chopra meme generator.
Yeah,
it's just like that. Yet, it sounds just scientific enough.
Was that also the article that said flushing a speak and spell down the toilet?
Oh, maybe. Yeah. It's all those things.
Oof, that food card, though. Come on.
It activates the pro-nutritional vibrations in the food.
Yeah.
Sold out.
Tara, I mean, come on.
Sold out. Yeah.
All right, George, you told me that you have this game you want to play with
us. I have a very silly game that we're going to play with the SGU, because why not? So does anyone know what a spoonerism is?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So there was this professor.
My wife and I do it every night in bed.
Ooh! Yeah. Follow that.
I thought your forkerism in bed, but
so there was this professor. I forget what his first name was, but there was an actual professor, Dr. Spooner, and he would transpose the first parts of words with the second parts, and he would so any sort of compound phrase he would sort of mess up. So like McDonald's would become Dick Monald's. You know what I'm saying? So you hear this kind of happen all the time. So I made up a little game here. We're going to go down so that everyone has a chance to get some points. Made up of spoonerisms. This game is called Spoon Me for you, Steve.
Thank
perfect.
You.
Okay. So for example, if I were to ask the question, who was the man that started the Ray Jeff? Who was the man that started the Ray Jeff? The answer would be
Randy.
No, the answer would be Rames Jandy.
So
we have to answer it.
We have to answer it. Yes, have to answer with the spoonerism. So the answer is Rames Jandy. Okay, does that make sense?
Not going to be good at this.
This is really stupid, but it's just I just had so much fun making these up. So we're going to go down. So I'll give each person individually. You'll have a chance first. If they don't come up with it, then someone else can chime in. Whoever wants to chime in for the throwaway. So
how much do you want to bet that Jay is an accidental genius at this game?
I don't even understand the game.
Because you have such a hard time pronouncing certain words. You always do
this. Oh, I do. Yeah, you do.
Unintentional.
Yeah.
Are we clear on the rules? Understand how this is working now? No, so the clue will have a spoonerism in it. So again, so I said, yeah, who was the man that started the Ray? It's supposed to be the JREF is the organization. The James Randi Educational Foundation is called the JREF. But I said, who was the man that started the Ray Jeff? And the answer is Rames Jandy. Okay, Evan's going to be the first one. Ready? Here's the first question. Speaking of Rames Jandy, what was the title of the book by Rames Jandy that featured Potter Peepoff?
First, we have to know the answer to the question.
No, it's on the what was the title of that damn book?
I'll say it again. What was the title of the book by Rames Jandy that featured Potter Peepoff? Anyone else jump in?
Is it The Haith Feelers?
The Haith Feelers is correct. Yes,
The Haith Feelers. Thank you.
Feelers. 1 point for Steve. Very nicely done.
I thought it might be his Flim Flam book.
Oh, that would be a hard
one. It wouldn't be that. That's why I didn't pick that.
Nice try. Nice try, Bob. I was hoping for
just
that.
The same letter for both parts. It doesn't quite work. Okay. Kind of
Flim Flam. Yeah. Spoonerism. Flim Flam.
Flim Flam is Flim Flam. Yeah. Okay. Jay.
Yes.
What rind of K's helped create the Incredible Hulk?
I know. Wait. Ramagaze.
Ramagaze. That's correct. Very good.
Yeah, I wouldn't have known the answer to that one.
Steve, are you ready?
Yeah.
What podcast is hosted by Sitchard Ronders?
That would be, I know what the old name was. The Teptic Skank. But I don't know what his new one is. The
Teptic Skank.
The Zeptic Scone.
The Zeptic Scone.
Zeptic Scone is the correct answer. The Very nicely done. Okay, Kara, let's see. Okay, who is known as the ad bastronomer?
Oh, Plil Flate.
Yes, good enough. Yes. I would say Pil Flate, but that's fine. Oh. That's fine. So wait.
It's Phil and Plate. So
yeah,
it would be so Plil Flate.
Pil Flate. You could say,
Fate. Yeah, Plil Fate.
Okay, good. That's right. Bob, you ready?
No.
Bob.
Make it a good one.
Okay, this is a good one. Who wrote Twitch Hrunty 2 and the Pissionary Musician?
I don't know. Richard Rawkins.
Christopher Trichens.
Christopher Chickens, yeah.
Say it again?
Christopher Kitchens?
No.
Christopher Chickens.
Chickens.
Christopher Trichens, yes, very good. Okay.
Trichens, yeah, not chickens.
I went for Richard Dawkins by
accident.
You could
say Christopher Chickens. That would also be correct, right?
Christopher.
Okay, Evan, chickens. Back to you.
All right.
We're going to keep doing this? Okay.
You know what this is? This is like, anybody in here fluent in another language? Like anybody in here?
Sure.
Yeah. So you know how when you're first learning the other language, you have to translate everything in your head?
Yeah.
That's this feels like.
Everything.
It's so slow.
Yeah.
I want to be fluent in spoonerism.
Evan, you ready?
Ready.
Who is the host of Winfo ores.
Oh, that is Jalex Owens.
Jalex Owens, very good.
Jalex Owens.
Jalex Owens, very good. Okay. Jay.
Yeah.
Star Wars question for you, Jay.
Yes.
Ready?
Yes.
Who originally owned the Fallenium Malcolm?
That would be San Holo.
No.
Originally?
Originally owned.
Can I get a second guess? Well, I don't know who the original original
was. Come on. Before San Holo.
Larissian.
Kando Larissian. Yes. Very good. Very good. Okay.
Now, what if I ripped out the original owner's name?
I looked it up. I couldn't find the original owner.
Good.
Yeah, I went on Wikipedia. Does anyone know? Is there anyone before Lando?
Because
owned
in movie
it?
Two, the shitty ones, the Millennium Falcon can see landing on the planet. I forget the name of the planet.
Wikipedia.
And was Lando flying it then, or was it Han?
Can you see? Can you? Or is it too far away?
Well, it was in the movie. It's there. Somebody's flying the damn thing.
Steve.
Not a good sign.
Okay. What is, or name, Ray Tartar Jolkin's Tramus Philogy?
Oh, how do you do that?
Lord of the Lings?
Lord of the Lings. Very good. Very good. Lord of the Lings.
Is this right. J.R.R. Jolkin? Is
yes.
That
J.R.R. Jolkin. Ray Tartar Jolkin.
Ray Tartar Jolkin. I
thought it was Jar Jar Binks.
I thought he was going Jar Jar Binks.
That's coming, Bob.
Yeah. Bob. Okay. Kara, ready?
Yeah, yeah.
Which Niantist's semesis was Iomos Tedison?
Tomos Yedison?
Which Niantist's semesis?
Oh, is this Tickle a Nessla?
Tickle a Nessla. Very good. Tickle a Nessla. Very good. That's a tough one. That's a tough one.
Good job, Tickle Kara.
Oh my God, what a delightful name, Tickle a.
Tickle a Nessla. Sounds like a Harry Potter character.
And you're Tickle a.
Bob, are you ready? Who is the oldest Bovella Nother?
That's no Jovella.
No Jovella. Very good. Yeah. No Jovella.
That's no Jovella.
That's our brother who's not here.
It's my twin.
Okay. Back to Evan. Okay. Evan, ready? Mm. The Bith Musters comprises of these Mu-10.
Oh, that would be Saddam Avage.
Right.
And Haimy Gyneman.
Very good. Okay, Jay, another Star Wars question.
Okay.
Ready?
Yes.
What is the official title of War Stores Thepisode Re?
Okay. Give me a second here. I'm very tired.
Anyone can jump in.
Sivenge of the Rith.
Sivenge of the Rith.
Son of a bitch. Good job, very Steve. Good, it was coming. It was coming.
Okay. Steve. This is, ready, Steve?
This all right, we swapped one each now. Okay.
Name all of the whore forcemen.
Biblical or atheist?
Atheist.
Theseist.
Theseist?
Atheist.
So it's Christopher Kitchens.
That's one.
Dietrich Rawkins.
Dietrich Rawkins, very good.
Ham Saris.
Ham Saris, very good.
And
what's the fourth one?
Who's the fourth one?
Anybody out there? No.
It's not.
Say it again. What?
Daniel Dennett.
Daniel Dennett. Very good. Yes. Daniel Dennett. Very good. Very good. Okay. Cool.
Daniel Dennett.
Yes.
I see. Okay.
Daniel Dennett.
Okay. Kara.
Oh yes.
What is the Asian art of furniture placement?
Oh, that's Sheng. Wait. Sheng Fui.
Very good. Very good. Okay. Bob.
Yes.
Often performed in parks, what is the Asian martial art practiced for its belf benefits?
Oh. Crap, I know this.
We used to enjoy this at restaurants before I had to go off camera.
Oh. Yeah, chai tea.
Chai tea.
Good job, Bob. Did you assist him?
No.
That was good.
That's a. Is there a name for that kind of spoonerism? That actually makes
makes it into another word.
Must be some kind of. Yeah. So Evan, name a heist spot drink.
What is it?
Sapolider?
Tai Chi.
Tai Chi. Yes, Tai Chi. Tai Chi.
Very good. Very good.
That was a trick question.
See what I did? Because it was like a flippy.
But hey, Sapolider counts too.
That just got too meta for me.
I actually got confused.
I couldn't get a second.
Wait, wait,
my
wait,
tea,
we just did that.
I couldn't get the second part.
Okay. Oh, all right. Where we Jay, yes? Which actress advocated Vantiax?
Which actress? That was...
Why are we so tired?
Menifer Jakarthy.
That's right.
Oh. Yeah, Menifer Jakarthy.
Menifer.
Okay, Menifer, yeah. Jakarthy. Menifer Jakarthy or Manny Jakarthy. Very nice. Oh, very right. Nice. Okay. Steve, here's a hard one. Because you're good at this.
Stereotype threat there.
What is a spherical selection of stars that orbits an Oort?
Globular guster?
Yes.
Close. Globular...
Gluster?
Yeah. Gluster. Right, yeah, yes. Globular gluster.
Oh, yeah, there's two L's in there. Globular cluster.
Okay. Kara, what game is usually at the end of every episode of Geptic Side Thutavuniyurs?
Fiance or Siction?
Very good.
All right.
If I didn't know that, that would be bad.
And then...
Another one for Bob.
Another one for Bob.
Bob.
Okay.
We don't have to do it.
Which SGU rogue was born in Tlano, Texas?
Sarah Cannamaria.
That's what everybody calls me, weirdly.
Sarah Cannamaria?
People call me Sarah Cannamaria all the time on accident.
Really?
Yeah.
That is
it's
crazy.
A common
they spooner you?
False spooner. Yeah.
See, I had Sarah Mantacaria or Mara Cantasaria.
Mara Cantasaria.
Those are the two.
Yeah. But Sarah Cantamaria is incredibly common.
Okay.
Cool.
It's weird.
Finally, up for everybody, Ravi. Who travels true thyme with companions like Pammy Ond and Toes Ryler?
Hachter Drew.
Hachter Drew.
Hachter Drew.
Hachter Drew.
Hachter Drew. Hachter Drew. If you want to say it like Brian the Dog.
Very nice. What else we got here?
Whip.
Oh, what is the alternative Edison that removes Wear-X? Wear-X. Sorry, Wear-X. What is the alternative Edison that removes Wear-X?
Kier Andling.
These make me so happy. I don't know why they make me so happy. And finally, one more Star Wars.
Oh, the ones with vowels are hard.
Oh, this is my favorite one. Who did Listopher Cree play in Clack of the Atones?
No idea.
Daunt Cuckoo.
Daunt Cuckoo. Very good. Very good. And I see by the score that I won. So there we go.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Are you guys ready for Science or Fiction? Okay. All right, this week, Evan is substituting for Science or Fiction. Evan, take it away.
Thank you very much, Steve. Each week, Steve normally presents us with three items. Two are real and one is fiction. It is up to the panel and all of you to decide which one is the fiction. Is everyone ready?
Yes.
Yes.
Would my lovely assistant please hand me the paper? She's been taking good care of it all evening. My daughter Rachel, everyone. I had the distinct pleasure of hosting my dear friend Richard Saunders for the past couple days. I'll eventually get that right. Yeah, and it was his first time coming to New England and New York as well.
Oh, never mind.
And being that this is the New England New York Conference for Science and Skepticism, we took a little trip the other day up to the Mark Twain House to have a little flavor of New England, which is in Hartford, Connecticut, the house where Mark Twain lived for 17 of his years and wrote his most famous books. So there is a theme for this science or fiction. Cool. It is Mark Twain.
All right.
Anybody Twark here Maine have expertise?
Twark, Maine.
Twark Maine.
Okay. All right, here we go. Number one, Mark Twain's first success as a writer was his 1865 short story, The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County. However, the story was not his own creation. An acquaintance in a bar told him the story, and he adapted it into the famous short story. Number two, Mark Twain kept both cats and dogs as pets. He loved cats, but he did not care much for dogs. At one point, his family had three pet collies, which he named Beelzebub, Pestilence, and Blatherskite. Number three. Mark Twain and his wife Olivia slept in their bed in reverse with their heads at the foot of the bed and their feet at the head of the bed, and they slept in a propped-up position because they believed it was healthier than sleeping lying down. Should we poll the audience first?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so with a single clap, you're going to, for those who think it's number one, which is the jumping frog story, that it was not his, it was told to him by someone in a bar, give me a single clap if you think that one is the fiction.
You ready? Are you ready? Like right when it's there. Okay, ready?
Thank you, George.
Here we go. Number one.
Okay. If you believe number two, this is the one about dogs and cats, and he didn't quite like dogs as much as cats, and he named them all these awful names. If you think that's the fiction, fuck.
Together, right? Come on.
Yeah.
All right.
Louder.
The third one, about sleeping in the bed in reverse, if you think that one is the fiction.
Right.
That was a pretty even split.
Yeah, I didn't
think
even.
2-3 was probably
thanks,
a
that was not helpful
one.
At all.
So we're going to see if, now we're going to pass it right down the line, starting
okay,
with Jay.
So the first one about the celebrated jumping frog of Calaveras County. That's an interesting title. I've never heard it. I'm
really
mildly surprised I haven't heard that. I do not think that this one is the fiction, however. I do think that Mark Twain would have listened to a story and thought, I can make that much better, and decided to write it. So that one, I believe. Second one here, kept both cats and dogs, didn't like dogs, liked cats, and named them these funny names. That is so Mark Twain. I totally believe that one. And I, the last one, I don't believe about them sleeping on an angle, and they thought it was healthier. And I'm making this decision solely on, I don't think Mark Twain... I think he was a critical thinker of the day. I think he wouldn't have fallen for something like this.
Steve,
I'd
next.
Like to say, Evan, can I ask you a question? Are
yes.
these things you learned while you were touring the market?
They are things I learned while touring. My guide's
so
name was
hard.
Al, and he was
and,
quite...
And you vetted them independently?
I did. In fact, I had to call the Mark Twain House today to verify a couple of the things that had to do with today. So
Richard knows the answer?
Richard does. Yes, he does.
Yeah. So... Yeah, I mean, I've heard of the jumping frog story. I've never heard about the second part though, that it was cribbed from a bar story. But that sounds plausible. The dogs and cats one, who knows? Does sound like Twain, the names. Maybe he named the cats that and not the dogs.
Yeah.
Would Evan do that? I don't know. I like Jay, I wanna believe the third one is the fiction, but my thinking is that is exactly the kind of thing you would learn touring Man's House. Because the bed were propped up.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was something else in the sleeping arrangements. I don't know. That could easily be the fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I'm going to go with Jay and say that the sleeping one is the fiction.
Okay.
So the inclination with the sleeping one is to try to imagine how that actually works. How do you have a bed device so you can be switched, that you can both be inclined?
Just prop up on pillows.
Pillows?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that enough? Like, or are they sitting sort of upright? So I'm trying, okay, maybe pillows will do it. See, now I would think that in the story of the frog, he says he heard this, but I don't think he actually heard it from someone else. So I believe the cats and dogs are the names are correct. I believe that he would sleep with his wife separately or facing different directions. But I think even though in the story he says that he heard it from someone else, that wasn't true. So I'm going to say the frog is the fiction.
Okay. Kara?
Yeah,
that's a good argument.
I think some people sleep propped up because they get heartburn, right? I think that's a thing that people do. So I don't see why that would be back then. Yeah, sleep propped up and maybe you get heartburn. I don't understand why they would sleep in it in reverse, personally. And there's no explanation here, so I will be interested for you to fill us in on that.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the dogs and the cats thing. I think it's pretty funny, though. It says that he named them Beelzebub, Pestilence, and Blatherskite. Blatherskite?
I love that.
That's probably not what their actual names were. Like, according to his parents, that's probably just what he named them. Unless that was, like, when he was older. And, yeah, his family. It doesn't say if it was his parents or not. I think I'm gonna go with you and say that, he did not actually overhear the story. I mean, his first success... I think he probably had so many ideas already and was really pushing to get them published. And he probably picked the best thing he had written to try to publish at that time. So I would assume it wouldn't be something that he stole from somebody else. So I'm going to say that's the fiction, too.
And Bob.
Yeah, I definitely read knew, kind of knew that the frog one was, that it was his first popular book. I never heard about adapting it from a story. I'm sure it's possible. The pet one, yeah. I mean, just the name Blatterskites is so awesome. I'm going to go with that one for that reason alone. The bed one, it's like, how do you know they, strikes me as, that's got to be real because you're doing a tour and you say, here's Mark Twain's bed. He slept like normal people over here. Like, how do you know? Like, that's got to be a thing. It's got to be a thing in my mind. So I'm going to go with the frog as fiction and join these two cool Yay. People.
Okay, Bob Kerr and George are the frog and Steve and Jay are the bed. And nobody took the cat's
gonna
dog.
Going to pull the audience again.
So yes, and we're going to pull the audience.
So let's see. Right. Number one, in regards to the frog, you're going to clap if you believe it's the fiction. Number two, in regards to the cats and dogs, you're going to clap if that's the fiction.
Influential.
And number three, the one about the bed sleeping in reverse.
Crap.
So okay, I think you've had an influence over the audience, most certainly. Why don't we take these in, why don't we start with the one that nobody took?
Yeah.
Okay, that would make sense. Okay, so it was number two. Mark Twain kept both cats and dogs as pets. He loved cats, but he did not care much for dogs. At one point, his family had three pet collies, which he named Beelzebub, Pestilence, and Blatherskite. Nobody thought that this was the fiction of our panel, and this one is the fiction.
Congratulations!
Mark Twain loved both cats and dogs. He was a big animal lover. His quotes are filled with positive praise for all sorts of animals, cats, dogs, and other animals, and really kind of beats down humans as like the worst of the animals, in fact.
Wait a minute.
Couple of his quotes. The dog is a gentleman. I hope to go to his heaven, not man's. And heaven goes by favor. If it went by merit, you would stay out and your dog would go in.
Were these his pet's names?
Yeah, the pet's names, those were three of the names of his cats.
The three said that.
That's right. You did say that,
but it, almost went
you
with
almost
that.
Went with that. He did. They did have three pet collies. Their names were I Know, You Know, and Don't Know. That's Mark Twain.
Yeah. Damn it, Evan, you're so good.
Yeah. I was inspired. Yeah. I don't know what to say. I don't know. What
so
else
he
to
slept.
Say.
Like with his head up and opposite his wife.
You want to go to that one next? We'll take.
I'm just now that I know I lost. I just want to know what the
Let's talk about the frogs first, and we'll get to the bed. Yeah. Okay. The first one, Mark Twain's first success as a writer, was his 1865 short story, "The Celebrated Jumping Frog of Calaveras County." However, the story was not his own creation. An acquaintance in a bar told him the story, and he adapted it into the famous short story. That one is science. Mm-hmm. He admitted this in a follow-up. Article that he wrote in 1894 called The Private and Public Story About the Celebrated Jumping Frog. It was about a 9-page article that I actually read, and that's exactly what happened, is that he was approached actually by a professor who approached him and said, you know, your story about the frog is actually thousands of years old. It was told in Greek times, and he went through and told him the story of the Greek version. And Mark Twain went, you know, looked it up basically himself and did. And he found it. He found that version of the story. And in fact, and then he kind of put it all together. It's like, okay, yes, this story has kind of been told in a sense sort of through the ages. But there are a lot of similarities between the Greek story and the one that he did learn from his acquaintance while he was in California in the 1850s. He did. And he said that how did he describe it? He said, the story was told to me by a dull, sullen Californian who told it horribly. He said it was like the worst telling of a story that he ever heard. And he said, I got to fix this, basically. So he took it, he wrote it, and it became his first his first big, big seller, famous story. So that one is science. And then the last one, Mark Twain and his wife Olivia slept in their bed in reverse with their heads at the foot of the bed and their feet at the head of the bed. They slept in a propped up position because they believed it was healthier than sleeping lying down. That one is science. He and his wife, while they were part of a tour, they were in Italy. And they saw this beautiful, beautiful, almost like a sleigh bed, but it had all these ornate carvings in it of angels and other things. They said the bed cost about $200 at the time, which would be close to about $5,000 now. And the head of the bed was just so beautiful, that story tells that they loved looking at it. So they decided to sleep at the foot of the bed.
Oh,
and look at the head. Look at the head of the bed. And also, as far as being propped up, Twain propped himself up in that bed and did lots of things. He wrote in the bed. He ate in that bed propped up. Mm-hmm. He smoked cigars in that bed propped up. There are pictures, photographs of him in that bed propped up. Mm-hmm. And yes, according to our tour guide, he did it also for reasons which he thought would benefit his health. And I think perhaps acid reflux may have been one of the things. Yeah. They didn't know what to call it back then. But
or sleep apnea.
Because, hey, if you're eating in bed, then you go to lay down, you know, you're probably going to get some acid reflux. Yeah. But if you fall asleep in this in the upright position, that will alleviate that.
Maybe he was Minbari.
Yeah.
Who gets that?
I got that. I thought of that.
Did they talk about how he got his name? How he chose?
How he chose the name. Yes, they did talk about that. He was a riverboat pilot on the Mississippi River for quite a long time.
Pilot.
And which he was fascinated with. And you call out certain things when certain things are called out, like the depth of the water, so you know if it's safe to traverse these waters or if you're going to get into trouble. And Mark Twain is one of those measurements, essentially. And he decided to take that and use it as his own.
Yeah.
Why did he pick the name, though? Was it a better name for an author at the time? Like Samuel Clemens is a pretty cool name.
It is a pretty cool name. No,
I don't know. It's interesting.
Well, he wrote under a few different names, Puddinhead something or other, right, Richard, and a few others. So
was that for different types of
different sorts of sorts of stories?
I think he wanted that sort of river traveling thing. It's like an inside joke already.
Oh, right.
It's a river term, and it's like a southern stories and expressions about river life.
And I suppose once his Jumping Frog story became a big seller, he decided to hang on to the name because, hey, the name goes with the story. Now I have to write more as Mark Twain.
Right.
And then he had that biography that he wrote that he said, don't look at this for 100 years correctly.
Boy, they didn't talk about that on the tour.
Does anyone know, am I crazy about that? That he had, it was just released like a year or two ago, right? Oh, okay. I can't tell time. Because of the damn clock. but he basically wrote an autobiography and said, like, don't read this for a century. Like, that's balls. That's like anyone's going to care 100 years from now. But, like, he totally, and people, it's a bestseller. It's just.
But I bet you some people read it in between.
I wonder.
And they read it inclined in bed, I'm sure.
Right, right.
Good job, that was fun. The rare sweep. So hope you enjoyed that.
Well, guys, we have time to take a few questions. If any of you have any questions you'd like to ask the panel. Yeah, so the question is
who should answer the hair growth question? I wonder which one of the panel should address the efficacy of lights on your head.
Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't work.
Well, you sure about that? Now wait.
Well, let's restate his question because he wasn't mic'd.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, the question is LED light that you would shine on your skin, is there any truth to that or is that all BS? And can it grow hair?
Yeah,
and George assures us. Yeah. The short answer is that the little lights you buy to heal your pain or whatever is bullshit. I mean, there's no evidence for any of that. But again, lights are, they're sexy. And they're also cheap. So you'll notice that crack devices tend to follow marketable items, right? If you could sell something cheap that does something interesting, then it's a setup, right, for a crack device.
And there's just something about having a blink. Like, we have them on the set.
Yeah.
And they do nothing. Like, having a blinky light makes something look more like technology.
Absolutely, yeah.
Right? Well, that said, I had alopecia areata. I've been to a dermatologist many times. She strikes me as, somewhat of a critical thinker. She, at one point, she recommended to me, she's like, Bob, there's been some types of lights, some frequency of
light.
She's
talking about PUVA, probably, which is ultraviolet light, which is used to treat skin conditions.
Right. So this, she said, it's like incorporated into a hat you could put on. It's like $800, so it's not like a $25 device that you're going to buy at Amazon.
It's not a little blue LED light.
No, it's not. So it's a specialized device. So, yeah. So she said it helps some people.
Yeah, I had I had psoriasis when I was young.
Yeah, it's used to treat psoriasis. Yeah, getting PUVA.
So it's not that specific application is not completely out of bounds.
I do the opposite. I pay someone to go get treatments where they put a laser on my legs and then I don't grow hair. Mm-hmm. And it works.
Fry your hair follicles.
It works. Yeah.
There's a light treatment for tooth whitening. That's legit.
Yeah.
But then there's cheap versions of that aren't legit.
Right.
Exactly.
So for every version of a legit thing, there's always.
But I've seen this device though. I've seen a commercial of it, and it literally is like one LED light. It's complete. utter bullshit.
Yeah. The low-end, cheap low-end stuff.
Right.
Okay, next question. You had one back there.
So what percentage of emails that we get from the show are from true believers versus from skeptics? It's 99% skeptics. Yeah. Most of the email that we get are from people who've been listening to the show and are generally skeptical, no question.
And they're really kind. Like, the vast majority of emails we get are really, really kind.
Yeah, and then even when they're pointing out, like, they're either expressing an opinion or they're saying, here's some new information that adds to what you were talking about. Mm-hmm. Just want to participate in the conversation. Or sometimes it's a
sacred cow for a skeptic, right?
Well,
a skeptic
sacred cow. Sometimes it's a skeptic, but we touched upon something and that they don't like.
Well, sometimes they're pointing out mistakes we made.
Yeah, sometimes they're pointing out flat out mistakes.
Quite often, that's true.
Delete.
And then occasionally we get people who have like so much of a sacred cow, you could say they're really not skeptics. So, but those are definitely the exceptions, but we get them occasionally. And then we get the convert emails, which are always the best.
Those are the best.
They feel like, I used to be a creationist, but then you guys showed me the light.
I listened to your show because I wanted to hear what the other side had to say.
Yeah.
What a great attitude.
And what happens is,
it's a great attitude. Just
so already they're self-selected for willing to listen to us openly. So they could, because they wanted to debunk us.
Yeah.
But then they realized they couldn't. Like, we were like, wait, these guys are being rational.
And I think part of it is we have a good relationship, so we all like, we're having fun on the show, and I think people kind of buy into, they like that familial feel and everything, and next thing you know, they're learning something, and
I'll tell you,
incredible.
The other thing is, though, I think a huge part of it, obviously that's part of the vibe of the show, but the true believers think skeptics are assholes. Because that's what they're told. That's part of the narrative.
Yeah.
And every time I have, I've debated homeopaths and whatever, I've gone into venues that were not skeptical, that it was a true believer venue, and I was representing the skeptical opinion. Their reaction was like, you're actually a nice guy. You're
like
not
Dr.
this
Ross, right?
three-headed demon that I thought all skeptics were. Yeah. Yeah. They have such this cartoon negative image of straw man of skeptics. Mm-hmm. It's really easy to convince them that, no, we're not that ridiculous cartoon that you were told.
Yeah.
And so immediately like, oh, wait a minute, this is not what I thought I was going to encounter. These are actually decent people who are being reasonable, So it's the bar, in other words, is set really low.
Sure,
because,
of course.
Because, again, the straw-manning of our position that they buy into.
I think only a really, really small percentage of the emails that we get are from people being, like, nasty.
Yeah.
Like, that's really rare that somebody will either be like, you're wrong, and I'm going to tell you why you're spreading lies. Like, it does happen. Or, honestly, I think even more often, it'll be, like, sexist emails directed at me.
Yeah, those are the most...
Like, that's more common than...
The majority of emails that are negative are they're either sexist.
They're either about my vocal fry or about my laugh.
Yeah.
Probably. Yeah.
Or tell that woman to shut up.
Yeah, she talks too much. Oh, yeah.
She interrupts too much.
So we just ignore those.
Yeah.
And then some are like, we just got an email from somebody who was, I can't remember exactly what they said, but it was completely worthless. Don't ever send this kind of email. And it was basically what was useless about it was that it had no specifics.
No context.
There was no context. There was no specifics. It was just a vague, like,
you were wrong about this.
Not even that. It wasn't even like you were wrong. It's just like, you guys shouldn't talk about this kind of stuff anymore because you don't really do a good job. Talk about this.
It was about farming, I think.
Was it? Yeah. Whenever you talk about farming, you guys, I don't like what you guys have to say.
Well, or health.
Can you give us an example? What do I do with that
information? Didn't you respond?
I did.
There's nothing I can do with this because you gave me no specifics.
You've got it yet. Yeah.
Well, you realize that people are like listening to the show that may have been recorded 11 years ago.
That's true.
And they just write an email and they say, you said that fish are dumb. And you get this email saying, I can't believe you think fish are dumb. And you're like,
I know. Did I? Was it no context? And you have no idea.
But you understand.
What
to them, you just said it. Yeah. Yeah. You just said it. So. Yeah.
And then sometimes you get, it's funny, like we've gotten a few emails about when I was talking about coconut oil on the show, and people saying, but this, and but the American Heart Association, but I have. And so then Steve will sometimes respond and like say, okay, but based on the evidence, this, and let me point you to the study. And then they'll come back and say, except. And then finally there was one recently where he was like, enjoy your saturated fat. Yeah. Like, I don't know if you really want them. I'm not telling you not to eat that.
Just linking you to the evidence.
Yeah.
Just the science. Anybody else? Other questions?
Yeah. Which is, again, we were talking about this on the workshop earlier today, that Yeah, it's very easy to dismiss information you don't like by calling it fake news, or that's biased. It's biased, or it's a fake site. It's dismissive. And so, yeah, there's no short way to really deal with that. You have to just explain to them, it's like, well, you're dismissing entire sources of information based upon some other source of information, which are you saying that they're not biased? Mm. So what kind of analysis have you done to come to that conclusion? Yeah. And it's usually none. Like, they don't really have any data. They don't have any analysis. It's just, I heard that they're not reliable or whatever. They're just repeating a narrative that somebody handed to them.
It's also a flimsy argument, because we're not going to come up here and talk about something that one article on Snopes wrote about and nobody else has done any research on. Like, there's going to be multiple sources for the things that we discuss. Often, we discuss, like, meta-analyses. That was kind of the coconut oil issue. People are like, the AHA, the American Heart Association, is biased. And it's like, I don't care. They're talking about other people's research.
But they also say, that one email was like, you're basing your opinion on this one study by the AHA. I'm like, all right. First of all, it wasn't a study. It was a systematic review. Second of all, I never base my opinions on one systematic review or one person's opinion. I looked through the literature, which I could get access to and read, and here's some links to some other independent systematic reviews by other people coming to the same conclusion. Yep. And that's when they just double down and go, like it.
And then you said, stop writing, George, because it's getting annoying.
And that's not to say who's that, obviously, George? A website like Snopes is like, great. It's amazing.
It's a starter.
It's a good starting point. Wikipedia is a good starting point.
But there's links there, too.
Exactly. Right. Like, dig out.
Okay, it is
9 o'clock.
It is 9 o'clock.
Look at that.
Great.
The sign does not lie. If anybody wants to talk about gravitational waves and how they might reveal hidden dimensions, come talk to me.
All right.
Just saying.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining me for this show, guys.
Thanks, Zach.
You're welcome.
It was a pleasure. Thank you guys for joining us.
Yay!
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible. We'll be right back.